Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5, for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 21, delivered on November 7, 2017. The title of this lecture is Systematic and Unsystematic Risk.
Tonight, Systematic and Unsystematic Risk. This lecture and the next one sort of culminate the entire story of introductory finance, and then we can move on, and after the break we move on for one or two more chapters, but this is really where it kind of comes to its fulfillment. Talking about risk, and I've talked about it over and over again, I began the course with a basic concept of the relationship between risk and return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. And then I moved that one forward a notch. The greater the risk, the greater the return was what I said first. And then I moved it forward a notch. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. And now we take it the full measure. And I begin with a question for you, sir. Okay. You obviously exercise every day. Do you even lift? Okay, but no matter how much you try, there's a point where you can't do anymore until you have taken some leap, started using anabolic steroid precursors or something like that, or gotten that adamantine stuff in your bones so you can be like Iron Man. But there's a place where you can no longer get any better. With a car, you can tune that car up all you want with the best spark plugs and all of that, but there is only a certain speed that you can attain with that. You are a car manufacturing company. You use lighter materials, plastics, composites, and all kinds of things, but there is only so far you can take that model of a car as far as fuel efficiency goes. No matter how much you spend, you can't get it to do better than a certain number of miles per gallon. Well, that is, interestingly enough, a principle of nature. We can even look back to my days when I was in astronomy. We can look at stars. No matter how fiery a star is of a certain size, a certain class on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, it cannot have more than a certain luminosity. We see stars of that size at different luminosities, but there is a certain brightness we would never see for a star that size. Everything in the universe seems to operate on this principle that there's only so far with a given amount of inputs that you can get an output. And so we come to this thing where I will draw this on the board first, and then because my hands aren't as good as they used to be, I'll switch over to a chart that I created. And there's plenty of these on the web. You can get these images. But suppose that we measure on the horizontal axis standard deviation. That's volatility. Remember that that volatility has, some of it is interesting to us, some of it is something we don't care about. Systematic versus unsystematic risk. But what we're going to do is look at standard deviations against returns of different stocks and portfolios. Now, this is just data. We download it. We do the Excel calculations. We're on a computer with some other program. And we find that we will see stocks landing at different sigma R combinations. Each of them is a data point, sigma, the standard deviation of the stock, or the portfolio, and we see an interesting pattern emerge. Over thousands and thousands of portfolios, small portfolios of stocks and bonds, we will see all of these data points scattering out, but they have a pattern to them. They have a pattern. And I'm going to draw that. I'm going to show you. This is a basic chart, and it was too small for me to put actual names on the portfolios and the stocks. This one is mostly just stocks I'm showing you here. Projector on, document camera, power. And let me zoom out just a little bit on this. Okay, good. And like I said, it was a little too intense for me to actually write, but these are actual stocks. And I could do this with portfolios, mutual funds, standard deviation of it. Like, for example, over here, if I'm not mistaken, that guy right there is Amazon stock. Up here is McDonald's. Cisco is over here. Somewhere, one of these. But like I said, I tried to put the little trading symbols in. It was just a little too intense. But those are all actual stocks. Return, the standard deviation of the returns. And I did this one for 20 years, if I had 20 years of data. 20 years of standard deviation against the average return on them. And you see that pattern. Something is preventing anything, any stock or portfolio or mutual fund, ETF, whatever, from going outside of that guy right there, that boundary. That in mathematics and in physics and essentially finance is really a branch of physics as much as it is a branch of anything else. That thing right there, that boundary, is what we call an envelope. Envelope. Now, you might have heard the term pushing the envelope. It's surprising how many people think that that means you're pushing a mailing envelope across the table or something. No, the pushing the envelope means something that is coming as close to the boundary as possible. We see these all through nature, in people, in animals, in planets and stars, in physical processes, mechanics, electricity. There is some performance that cannot be exceeded. In finance, we call this envelope the efficient frontier. Of all risky investments. The efficient frontier of all risky investments. That's what we call the envelope in finance. It's real. I mean, this is real data. It's just, in a way, it's kind of fascinating to see nature show us something about itself. And it's stocks, planets, stars, electrical system, mechanical systems, they all have an envelope. We give it a special name in finance, as it is given a special name in every subject. Like I mentioned in astronomy, there's something called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. In automobile mechanics, they call it the performance envelope. It's there. Okay, and like I said, there are a few highlight points. Like I said, Amazon's down in one of these, McDonald's up here, Cisco. There are some real, these out here are very highly volatile stocks, young companies mostly out in here. See, these standard deviations are way out there. Okay, now, the next part of this is where we get to the heart of finance. You see, if you were to invest in individual stocks, you would never be able to beat this performance envelope. If you were to put together a little, what's a bing bong bing? Oh, well, anyway. If you were to put together little portfolios by mutual funds, ETFs, they would never get off out of this envelope. Now, one thing that I do want to point out is right there on the envelope would be the most efficient portfolios you could create from individual stocks or portfolios. These are almost all theoretical. We hardly ever see one that's parked right on the frontier. They're always maybe a little tad inside it or really inside it. So in other words, right here, for example, Amazon. Amazon has a total standard deviation of this much. And it has a return of this much, at least historically speaking. Okay? So in other words, that would be sigma sub AMZN. And that would be the return to AMZN. If this were truly an efficient stock, the returns, it would have a return way up here. Or conversely, for that return, its volatility would be way down there. But it's neither, and no stock is. Like I said, on the efficient frontier, there is really nothing that we actually could see. But there is a theoretical place on there that's very important to us. I want to point out something here. There is one efficient portfolio that is not in the envelope. It's way outside of the envelope. It's almost a trivial portfolio. A portfolio of short-term treasury securities has no volatility. So in other words, its sigma would be here at zero. And its return would be the risk-free rate, at least theoretically. Okay? So there really is a portfolio that's perfectly efficient, but its return is trivial. It's the lowest return you could possibly get. It's sort of like that one, well, if you don't do anything, then of course you're not on the, you're not, the envelope doesn't address you. And so the risk-free rate, since you're not taking any risk, it's just sort of not even part of the envelope. But it is important, though, as I'll show you next. Well, let me get this. I brought an extra sheet of paper so I could have a straight edge. So I can make myself, since I forgot to bring a ruler tonight. That's just my usual forgetfulness. But I'm going to draw. I'm going to need a ruler for the next thing I'm going to do here. Okay. This is almost like a trick in a way, but it's a real trick. You can really do it, sort of. Okay. Now I'm coming back to a nice clean envelope. Again, this is the efficient frontier of all risky investments. And over here we have sigma on the horizontal axis, and a nice fat zero for the risk-free rate, like, let's say it's right here, R sub F. Now, suppose that I were to draw a line from the risk-free rate that just touches the efficient frontier. We say that's a tangent line to the efficient frontier. Like that. Okay? See that point where it touches? It wouldn't take much math, but it's enough to not be worth telling. I'll just tell you. That one point, it sits right on the efficient frontier. That is a portfolio that would have every security in the world in it. And each security would contribute by weight to the portfolio the same as it contributes by its market cap to the world's entire market cap. It's called the market portfolio. I remember I had a professor many years ago who called it the world portfolio. I kind of like that because you couldn't ever actually do this portfolio. You could never actually create this because, I mean, think of that. Every security in the world in the portfolio, each one in its weight in the world portfolio, in the world market, market cap of one. So, I mean, it's a theoretical animal, but it's very important to us because we can draw over here and we can say, okay, that theoretical, perhaps unattainable market portfolio, we would say that it has a return of expected return E of R sub MKT, the expected return to the market portfolio. Like that. Now, by the way, I'm going to put this picture up as a JPEG on the podcasting site, just in case you want to print it out and do this drawing yourself, just to get more of a feel for how it works. But anyway, that'll be in a few days. But here, look at this. Look here. Okay. If we could form the market portfolio, and we can certainly form a portfolio of treasuries, there's nothing real hard about that. Let me show you something. Here's a data point on this line. By the way, this line is called the capital market line. Now, you got to be careful because it's going to be another line I'm going to draw in just a minute on the board that has almost the same name. They're related, but they're not the same. Okay. But what this line can do for us, this capital market line, I can see that there is a data point right there on the line. So, in other words, there is a risk-free portfolio of treasuries. Its coordinates sigma against return would be for that one would be sigma would be zero and its return would be the risk-free rate. So I've got a data point on the line. It has no risk. Sigma is zero. The treasuries don't have volatility. You just buy them, and then at the end, you get your money. Okay, so now the next one that I would put in here is that I would see that there was a standard deviation for the market portfolio. And its return is E of R sub M, MKT. That's a pretty bad notation there. Anyway, okay, now here's where the jump comes. If it has every stock in the world in it, this theoretical portfolio, if it has every stock in the world in it, then it could not have any unsystematic risk. Let me repeat that. The world portfolio would have no diversifiable risk because you can't diversify what has everything in it. And again, let me put that. The market portfolio has no diversifiable risk. diversifiable risk. It has none whatsoever because you can't diversify what there's nothing else to diversify it with. It is the whole shebang. So in other words, the market portfolio would be a pure portfolio. So that purity gives us something that we can work with very usefully. Even though it's a theoretical thing, it has a usefulness to it. We can create a new measure that is only systematic risk. And we can say that because the market portfolio is so pure that it cannot have any unsystematic risk, we can say that the beta of the market portfolio, we can just say that's 1.0. It's our benchmark. It's the benchmark. Theoretical or not, we can use that benchmark to measure every other stock's systematic risk. There's also another place, too. The beta of the securities of treasuries or something that is purely risk-free, well, that would have the beta of the risk-free portfolio would have no risk. It would be a zero, a perfect zero. So we have actually two known places on this metric of pure, non-diversifiable, in other words, pure systematic risk. We have two data points for pure, non-diversifiable risk. We have, if we were to do beta against expected return, and we would do those as data points, I would have one data point that would be 0 R sub F, and I'd have another one that would be exactly 1 expected return to the market portfolio. I'd have two data points on a new line. See that guy over there and the one I drew up there, that has all the noise in it. It has systematic and non-systematic risk because I'm just measuring standard deviation. So it's volatility in the dirty way. It's got all kinds of noise in it, the diversifiable risk. Now we're going to shake out and talk about just pure non-diversifiable risk. Now, you remember somewhere in your dark, dark past, the equation, there was a way to write a linear equation by having 2 points on it. Somewhere in your ugly, dark past, you remember the two-point form of the linear equation? You remember you had to find, if you had 2 points, x sub 1, y sub 1, and x sub 2, y sub 2. I know, it's... Yeah, first thing you have to do is find the slope, m equals y2 minus y1 over x2 minus... Don't worry, I'm not going to do this for what I... Why? Really? Huh? Yeah, it's and then you can y minus y1 equals m times x minus x1. And you plug in and find M, and then you put one of the data points. It's a pain in the butt. We did it. And I'm not going to do it for you. But the underlying point here is, or 2 points is, that 2 points make up a unique line. 2 points. Well, I have 2 points on some kind of a very special line that relates non-diversifiable risk to expected return. That would be huge. Because I can actually create a model now. Now, I'm not going to do that. I could actually do it with these 2 points in this, but the notation with the little subscripts and all that gets to be way too confusing. So what I'm going to, for a class like this especially, I don't want my tires slashed tonight. So I will just show you. If I were to use the slope-intercept form of the two-point form of a linear equation on these two data points right here, which I know. I've just created them. They're mine. I can now write something, a new linear equation, that for any stock, the expected return to any stock is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta of that stock times the expected return to the market portfolio times the quantity expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. This is the linear equation that I can create from those two data points. And it's just a little bit of algebra. It's nothing really hard, but it just gets kind of, like I said, when you're using these little subscripts, it's a lot harder to understand what's going on than with x1, y1, and all that. This thing right here is called the famous capital asset pricing model. It's sort of the culmination of finance. It was actually found, strangely enough, it was in my lifetime that this was actually, this very simple equation was actually created by a couple of financial economists, Sharpe and Linton. But anyway, this is the CAPM. Now, I've talked about this before, and here I really suggest it. If you're thinking about getting a tattoo, you can't go wrong with this one. No, seriously. I mean, Instagram, instantly 10,000 followers, most of them the opposite sex. Mm-hmm. Okay. What scares me is someday someone's going to actually do that. Someone did do a tat of something financial, and it just creeped me out. Get away from me. But anyway, very committed to it, to the discipline. Anyway, okay. Now, this is the famous CAPM, C-A-P-M. We call it CAPM. Essentially, you tell me the beta of a stock, and you tell me the expected return to the market portfolio, what the current yield is on a completely safe treasury, and I can tell you what the expected return on that stock is. This is how we do expected returns on stock. We also can use this model for those discount rates while I was doing present values and future values. We can use this. This is where we get the discount rates, is from CAPM. At least we should. Some people just pull them out of thin air. But the bottom line of it is this. What we're saying, and going back to the graphic on the overhead, is that you shouldn't be investing in individual stocks or in small portfolios. Because if you can get something that is very close to the market portfolio, you combine that with a portfolio that is riskless, and you can form any portfolio you want and beat the efficient frontier of all risky investments. You try anything with just a couple of stocks here and there, you're in the envelope, that you wear the envelope. But if you discipline yourself to stay on the market portfolio or something that's close, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but if you just combine riskless treasuries and with the market portfolio, you can be anywhere in here. How you get out here is by borrowing or shorting, and you can with the shorting treasuries with the market, and you can get out here to even higher levels of risk. You don't need to be caught in the envelope. Essentially, anyone who wants, let me show you something right here now. Now, going back to the capital market line and the efficient frontier, let me show you, and I wish I could remember which one of these it was. I think this is Amazon right here. But let's look at Amazon. As a matter of fact, didn't I just do that? Yeah, I did. I did that on this one. Okay, now, if you decide, well, I'm just going to buy Amazon because I loves me some Amazon, and I'm just going to buy that stock and say the hell with everything else in the world. Okay? There is your total risk that you're eating. You're eating that whole risk profile. Now, let me draw the security market, the capital market line on this one. Okay. Now, this whole sigma, all of the standard deviation, all of the risk you are taking, the risk piece, this part of sigma from Amazon itself over to the security market line, that's diversifiable risk. That's non-systematic risk. That's risk you don't need to get. This is the diversifiable risk. Of Amazon stock. Only this part from the capital market line over to zero is the non-diversifiable part. Of Amazon. That's the part that you could not get rid of in an efficient portfolio. The rest of that, you're not going to get any, you should not expect any reward for taking that risk. And it boils down to a very practical matter. You're up against fund managers who have billions and billions and billions of dollars. They're on the capital market line. They're on the security market line. They are not going to trade to reward you for risk that they don't take themselves. They'll never take this risk. You will never win a penny overall over a long period of time. Well, I invested in Robinhood and I'm a freaking financial genius. Yeah, and watch what happens when the market takes its downturn, as it inevitably will. You will get your clocks cleaned and then you'll find out that amateur investors are what makes for a 3-martini lunch for the Wall Street boys. That's just the reality of it. You're wearing all of this risk in single stocks and in little portfolios of stocks. Yeah, you'll win in an up market. All boats rise when the tsunami hits. And then when it's sucked back out into the sea, suddenly you are in quicksand. And that's where we see right now. And that's one of the dangers of these amateur investment sites like that. It's like learning how to do real combat by playing Call of Duty. Yeah, no, seriously, that scares me. Maybe I mentioned one time my boy, years ago, the game Doom was the first of those FPS, first-person shooter games. He informed me that he was much better in combat than I had ever been when I was a soldier because he'd done so much more killing than I had. Go ahead, boy. Go out there. I'll clean up what's left of your goo later. Oh, but I humored him. That's good, son. Okay. Here's the thing. That this is where the pros are. They're not going to cut you slack. Oh, gee, you know, you took all this diversifiable risk. We'll reward you for that, too. No, they won't. Because their engines are at not just the frontier's performance level. Their engines are at the performance level that exceeds anything that any single individual engine could create. Think of this as Newtonian physics. This is quantum physics. I guess you could say it that way. Okay. Now, some things. By the way, the capital asset pricing model. Now I can draw the line for that one. Okay, this is beta. This is expected return to a security. Okay? And this could be a security or a stock or a portfolio of securities. But here is R sub F at zero on the beta, and then 1.0 would be the expected return to the market portfolio right here. And so you would have the 2 points and the entire capital asset pricing model. Cheating a little bit there. That's called the security market line. It plots beta against the expected return. Right here is the fulcrum at beta of the market portfolio. And then you, on this side, you are in defensive portfolios or defensive stocks. On this side, you're on aggressive portfolios or stocks. Now remember, when beta is being reported for a stock, you see it on Yahoo Finance, Morningstar, Bloomberg, whatever. That is telling you only the risk of that security if it is in a well-diversified portfolio. Beta measures the non-diversifiable risk of a security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Beta measures the non-diversifiable risk of a security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Beta measures the non-diversifiable risk of a security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Now, I just gave you that definition three times. What do you suppose that means? Is it important for to know, maybe for an exam? I want this to be one of the most important things you get out of this course, is because you really will be investors someday. Almost all of you. You'll do it for personal reasons, maybe. You might have a self-managed pension plan where you can decide what goes into it. You might invest for yourself. When you invest for yourself, like I said before, you can do all kinds of stupid things, take risks that you don't need to take. But when you get to managing a plan for other people, like the clients, or you're managing your portfolio for your family's future, then it gets serious. You can't just be taking willy-nilly diversifiable risks. You got to get up there on the capital market line. And that means diversify. Because that beta is going to tell you, well, I think I'll get a little aggressive. I'll take a beta of 1.2, and I'll just buy that stock. Well, what that means is you're probably going to have a total risk that is stupidly above 1.2. Because that 1.2 says that's how risky it is if you put it with a lot of other things. It's like I've talked about you. When you're alone, you are a crazy. And well, not like him. He is a truly CAMO, crazy-ass mofo. But you get him in a room with a bunch of people, look how calm he is. Yep, uh-huh. I mean, it's like the difference. When he's alone, Satanist. In here, Presbyterian. Okay? Cthulhu versus an anchovy. When you're alone, Cthulhu, slapping people with your tentacle mouth, and that's an anchovy. Anyway, real examples for real people. Where the hell was I? Okay, here, look. can't emphasize this enough. But okay, now let me. I'm going to do a couple of just little practical examples here, just to show you this how this works. But where was I? You see this little piece right here in the capital asset pricing model, the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. There's a name for that. There's a long name and then a short name. I'll give you the long name first. This is the expected market premium over the risk-free rate. The expected market premium over the risk-free rate. It's the expected return of the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. This is the number that tells you how much reward you should currently expect for taking a risky position instead of a riskless position. Again, it is the current expected reward for taking the risk of the market instead of no risk. Look, if you invest in treasuries, you're taking no risk and you're going to get a really bad return. If you invest in the market, you're going to get a bonus. So all this really shows you, E of R, the expected return to the market portfolio minus risk-free rate, it says, what's your bonus for taking risk instead of being a coward? Okay? You, madam, you could have actually left high school and gone to work at Walmart. You could have ended up 50 years from now being one of those weird old ladies who pushes around a cart in there. How are you doing? This is welcome to Walmart. Get out of my way, you ugly person. And putting up little things on shelves. You could have done that. A risk-free life. You would have made, $18,000 a year. But you instead took the risk that of going to college. Now, it might turn out that it didn't pay you anything, but you expect it to pay you more. That's why you're in college. You're not here because you heard that you could possibly take Professor C, the greatest professor who ever lived. You didn't do that. You're not in my class because you love yourself finance. You are here because you are willing to take a risk to maybe pull a $60,000 a year job coming out of the box. So in other words, your reward, your bonus is 60,000 minus 18,000, which is 42 grand. That's what that thing right there is showing you, is your bonus for taking risk instead of no risk. Okay? Not that working at Walmart doesn't have its benefits. You get a discount and you get to hang out with really cool people who work there with you. That's why you're here. Good, good. Okay. See, so this premium, and then, you see, when I put the beta of a stock on that premium, what I'm doing is I'm basically saying, what is the magnification or demagnification factor this security does on the bonus? It's like a magnification factor. So, like, if I took a 1.4 beta, it would magnify the expected market premium. If I took a beta of 0.6, it would demagnify. So this is basically, the beta is like the lever that pulls it out or pushes it in on you. Now I'm going to just do a quick dirty one here, just to show you this in practice. And I'm going to, let me switch over here real quick. I should have done this to start with, PC. Is there some reason the PC sucks? Okay, I see. Okay, now let me pull this up here. First thing I'm going to do here is I'm just going to pull Yahoo Finance. Oh, quit it. No, I don't want Firefox as my personal browser. NSA love child that it is. Where is it? No, I'm not paranoid. Okay, let's take a stock. Let's pull one out of the box here. Target, TGT. Well, TGT. I can't remember what the beta of that one's way. Oh, whoa. Okay, now look at that beta. That one is going to be a demagnifier. So, pulling these numbers, let's say that the expected return to the market portfolio right now is 12.4%. And short-term, really short-term, purely riskless treasuries, which we usually use, often use as a proxy for R sub F. It's not pure R sub F, but it's awfully, awfully close, is right now sitting at 1.2%. Now, the beta of target is 0.41. Now we can find the expected return to target stock. It would be, by the CAPM, the expected return to TGT is going to equal 1.2% plus. Now, by the way, notice that hanging R sub F. That's basically, the best way to interpret that is that anything that you invest in has got to at least return you riskless. Otherwise, why would you invest in anything that didn't even start with the risk-free rate and then build from there? That's why you see that Y-intercept at R sub F, what we call the affine. Okay, never mind that one. Okay, so now beta 0.41 times 12.4% minus 1.2%. Also, I should mention here that as long as you are working with just a CAPM, you can use the percentages on their own. What comes out of that, if you do other math with the expected return, you'd have to turn that into a decimal. But as long as you're working entirely within the cabin of CAPM, you don't need to change those percentages into decimals. So, in other words, right now, the expected market premium over risk-free is 11.2%. In other words, that's your bonus. That's your premium for taking risk instead of no risk, is an extra 11.2%, just like an extra $42,000. That's your bonus for taking it. And then when we do the beta, that will magnify or demagnify the expected market premium over risk-free. And by the way, that's the quick name for this. We say the expected, we just say, a lot of times we just say market premium over risk-free, or even just market premium. Okay, so we shorten this expected market premium over the risk-free rate. We usually reduce that all, sometimes down, you'll hear me just say market premium. Remember, market premium is expected return of the market minus risk-free. But anyway, now just honking that thing out on your calculator, just to show you the example, and this is really simple to use in practice. Surprises me it took to the 1960s to figure this little thing out. But there you go. Calculator, where the, oh, there it is. Okay, so I'm just going to take 1.2 plus beta of 0.41 times the market premium, which is 11.2, 5.792%. So that's what you expect to earn on target. That's your expected. It won't be that. It might be a little higher, a little lower, a lot higher, a lot lower. But there's your expected return to that security in a well-diversified portfolio. But it has to be, for this to mean anything, that beta and CAPM to work, You have to be in the market. You have to have this in a good portfolio. Now, taking this off here for just a little bit, the capital market line. Let me show you something here. I'm going to put this down. I'm going to bring it back up here but in a minute. But, oh. Yeah, let me switch over here just for a second. Up there, again, there is that, the capital market line and that efficient frontier of all risky investments. Now, as I told you, the market portfolio, oh, you just buy treasuries and you buy the market portfolio and, you know, you can just allocate as you want to go in and out on the security market line. Of course, the market portfolio really is just a purely theoretical animal. In other words, you go and call your broker, yes, I would like you to buy the market portfolio. He's going to say, what? However, fortunately, there are several portfolios and portfolio constructions, real world, that you can do that come really close to the true market portfolio, to the real deal. Now, I've mentioned some that are highly diversified portfolios. Like, for example, spiders. Spiders are actually, that's the Standard & Poor's 500. That's huge. That's a lot of stocks. But by weight, by market cap weight, those 500 companies are actually a tiny number of the companies total in the world, but they constitute like 70% of the market cap. I mean, God, that's all. In 500 companies, 70% of the world? That might not be right. It might be just the United States, but I think it's the whole. That's a lot, but it is only 70%. So holding a spider, and thinking you've got the market portfolio, no, you don't. You got 70% of it. So you've still got unsystematic risk in it. However, we do know, both theoretically and by research, empirics, studying and taking these and doing these, that even though this perfect market portfolio is just obviously unattainable, if you put together maybe four very efficient portfolios, not perfect, they're right near the frontier, you can come awfully darn close to an actual version of the market portfolio. I mean, you put together spiders and ags and big, fat, huge mutual funds. You put about four of those together and make sort of like a super portfolio of four portfolios or five. Oh, you're really, really close to what we know are the theoretical characteristics of the market portfolio itself. You start doing that. And by the way, there's a really creepy part of this that I was reading. I'm following as much as I can from my background in computers, the work that's being done to get us to true artificial intelligence. And one of the features that they figured out was not trying to let the artificial intelligence be exposed to a human personality, but letting these things be exposed to multiple human personalities. They get much, much more human acting. That's scary because they learn more. And in portfolios, we know that if we combine almost efficient portfolios, they get darn close to a true market portfolio. So what you would want to do as an investor is not just buy one well-diversified portfolio, because no matter how hard you try, it's going to not be the market portfolio. Put together some really nice ones, like I said, spider, ag, stuff like that, and you'll get a really nice close approximation of the market, as close as even the heavies do. I mean, they can't do any better than what you could do, because essentially they're doing for you. They're putting together these portfolios, so whither they go, you go with them. I'm going to show you something here. This takes you past 240. Maybe it's useful. It's absolutely important for you if you're going to do any kind of investment yourself. But it's also, it might kind of turn you on to finance. Finance at the undergrad and MBA level is not nuclear physics. It's not rocket science. It's algebra and a lot of arithmetic and different analyses, ratio analysis, and stuff like that. Let me show you something. I'm going to take everything off the board here. And I'm going to show you a measure. Beta is absolutely crucial to know. And I'm going to show you one more measure tonight and then a couple of more measures on Thursday night just to get you to the point where you know more than the average bear about investments and what to look for when you're looking at the numbers. Okay. Now, I'm going to draw the security market line up here again, the CAPM line. It's beta against expected return to a security or portfolio, okay? And it will go like this. This is the security market line, the CAPM line, okay? And we know that a beta of 1 would be the market portfolio, a beta of 0 would be a portfolio of treasuries or something riskless, okay? Now, in real world, the fund managers and the fund managers especially, they're going to form portfolios that are to a lesser or greater degree diversified. And so what we would expect is, okay, let's look at the beta. And in the next lecture I'll show you how to get the beta of a portfolio. It's really easy. It's just the weighted average of the betas of the pieces of it, of the components of it. But, okay, so we've got these fund managers who are going to form portfolios. The portfolio will have a beta. So let's say that we have a portfolio, right, that has a beta. Let's say this is portfolio A. Now, we can calculate the expected return to that portfolio. That would be the expected return to portfolio A, right there, okay? For that beta, the fund should earn that expected return, okay? But in the real world, it probably won't exactly. Now, the extent to which it doesn't, let's say that this return actually was a little less than what it should be for that beta. We have a name for that, and it will actually be in the reported data for a fund. That distance right there is called Jensen's alpha, or just the alpha. The more negative, the more the stock underperformed. The more positive, the more the stock fund overperformed. It's actually a very useful thing, because if you're making a portfolio, one of the ways that you can trade in your portfolio is every year clear out the negative Jensen's alphas. Just get rid of the funds and go find some Jensen's alphas that are positive. Let me show you one. I'm going to pull up a mystery right now that I've got on my hands here. There is a mutual fund. And apparently there are more than a few of these. It's in the Vanguard family, which is just tons of them. This is should be an insanely safe mutual fund because all it does is invest in treasuries. I mean, treasuries are like betas of 0, 0.1, 0.2, treasury bonds of all kinds. Watch this, though. I'm going to pull up finance.yahoo.com. And.com. Okay. Okay, VB LTX, is it? Is that the one I want? Yeah. Look at its holdings. This is a mutual fund, a Vanguard long-term bond index investor. Look at its holdings. Treasury bond, treasury bond, treasury bond, treasury bond. But look at the beta of that son of a that thing. Do you see that beta? 2.86? Seriously? Well, that is a scary thing. How could the beta of a portfolio of betas that are almost zero be a beta of 2.86? Well, that's the first thing that catches your attention. Now let me go over here. I'm going to pull up Google because I don't have my... Okay. VB LTX. LTX. Okay. Performance. Let me see performance. See if I can find. A lot of these sites are going to give you. Money. Let me see if it'll give me. A lot of these sites will give you these different things to look at. Oh, God. Okay. Category, 3 month, holdings. Nah, that's stupid. That was a waste. I know where to go. Now, I'll pull this up on Morningstar. Morningstar should have it. Oh, by the way, here's a website. It's a play on words, and only if you're smooth with investing do you get the joke, get the inside joke. There's a good website called Seeking Alpha. Well, gee, now you know what that means. You're seeking the positive alphas doing this. And why can't I find? Oh, wait, maybe I can go do it through here. Performance. Is it going to give me alpha, Jensen's alpha for this? Yield, fund. Huh. Doesn't give it to me here either. So it's going to have to be on Morningstar. I just dread going into Morningstar when I don't have to. But anyway, real quick here, let's go to Morningstar. Performance, VBLTX fund. Okay, Morningstar is sort of like authoritative with this stuff. So anyway, if I find this, if it will ever load so I can show you this. Come on. Really? Anyway, if you were to see the Jensen's Alpha, which is now just hanging here on this rapid internet system, you would find that the alpha was negative. And it's negative 0.27%. In other words, if this thing really does have a beta of 2.86, it should be earning about 0.25% more than it is, which means Jensen's Alpha at negative 0.27, that's a percent. That's something you should probably throw out of a portfolio. If for no other reason than because the beta is insane for what's in it, and also the fact that if you're seeking alpha, you're probably looking in the wrong place if you look at things that have negative alphas. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.